Today's guest, Stephen Greenblatt, is a literary critic and Shakespeare scholar. His newest book focuses on the discovery of a text written before the birth of Christ, so hardly cutting-edge news. But that text, a massive poem by Lucretius entitled On the Nature of Things, had been lost for about 1,000 years. And when rediscovered, the poem expressed a long-lost view of reality that ended up inspiring Renaissance thinkers. So the story is really blows me away, and the book, Greenblatt's book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2011. Stephen Greenblatt's subtitle, How the World Became Modern, makes the claim that the rediscovery of On the Nature of Things by the book hunter Poggio Bracciolini in 1417 unearthed ancient but dangerous ideas, that the universe functioned without the aid of gods, that religious fear was damaging to human life, and that matter was made up of tiny atoms in eternal motion. Those ideas pushed European civilization away from the religiosity of the Christian Middle Ages into a worldview that we recognize as our secular own. And they helped inspire the Renaissance and later influence the scientific thought of Galileo, Freud, Darwin, Einstein, the writing of Montaigne, Shakespeare, and even Thomas Jefferson. Stephen Greenblatt is John Cogan University Professor of the Humanities at Harvard University, the author of several books, including the best-selling Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. And his new book, as I said, is The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Welcome, Stephen Greenblatt.
Thank you, Terrence. Glad to be here.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we end up talking about on the show. So tell us a bit about your path to the work that you do today, and be free to mention mentors or turning points, moments of decision.
My path in this case began many, many years ago, decades ago, when I was an undergraduate in college. I used to go at the end of the year, rummage around at the campus bookstore to see what was on sale for almost nothing. And in this case, I saw in the bin a book whose cover caught my eye. It had a weird picture that I liked, a detail from a painting by the surrealist painter Max Ernst that showed two sets of legs up in the sky, disembodied legs, but they were doing something very strange. And the book was on sale for 10 cents. I'd never heard of the author or of the work, but I invested 10 cents in it. And sometime over the summer, I picked up the book and started to read it, not expecting very much, and I found that I was hooked, profoundly hooked by what I read. It was one of those weird experiences that I've had and that many listeners may have had sometime in their lives, in which suddenly something seems to speak directly to you. In this case, a work that was written 2,000 years ago seemed to be written for me.
And how old were you at that point?
Oh, 17, 18.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. And then you go on to become?
Fast frame.
Scholar, professor, etc.
I worked most of my career on Shakespeare and on Renaissance English literature, but always I had in the back of my mind, first of all, this work, which has always been important to me, but also the whole idea of the Renaissance. How is it possible for a culture to turn from one direction to another? How is it possible for there to be a shift in the way a whole civilization is thinking? And the Renaissance, of course, is in some ways the most remarkable moment of that kind, in which a whole way of thinking about the world changes. It doesn't change overnight, and it doesn't change because of a single thing. The discovery that I am writing about is only one piece of a large puzzle, but it's an important piece, and the discovery itself was an amazing event.
Okay. How many times have you read it?
Oh, I haven't counted it exactly, Terrence, but I reckon it's a long poem, 7,400 lines, so it's not daily
reading. Sure.
But I must have read it 15, 20 times in my life.
Yeah. And always in English?
Yeah, I read it in English originally. It's written in Latin, difficult Latin. My Latin teacher in high school Latin, very good high school Latin, and then my Latin teacher in college was none other than Eric Siegel, who wrote Love Story, strange to think of.
Ah, from Dunster House. I did plays there, and he had revived the Dunster Theatrical Society when he was an undergrad.
Well, he was teaching at Yale when I was there, and he was a Latin teacher of great power and consequence and excitement. So I have enough Latin to be able to read, though I wish I could read it more effortlessly than I do. I have to be careful and go slowly, but I've also read it in Latin. Those are the only two languages I've read it in.
Were you surprised by the popular success of Will in the World?
I was extremely pleased by it. It actually, and of course I was surprised in the sense that if you spend most of your life, as I do, writing for a relatively small audience, then it's very gratifying to discover that more than that tiny circle of people is interested. But in this case, my surprise was slightly softened by the fact that I had had an unusual experience, which was an encounter with a screenwriter from your part of the world, Mark Norman, who had come to see me when I was in Berkeley and wanted to talk to me about writing a film about Shakespeare based on, roughly based on Amadeus, the movie about Mozart. And I said, don't be ridiculous. There's really no movie to be written about Shakespeare. It's not an interesting life. Christopher Marlowe had the really interesting life, was a spy, a double agent, a counterfeiter, was murdered, and so forth and so on. But no, he said he wanted to do it about Shakespeare, so we went back and forth and talked about it a bit, and I had a few ideas, and it was fun. And then when it turned out that this screenwriter teamed up with Tom Stoppard and wrote Shakespeare in Love, I realized something at that point, which was that a very large audience, much bigger than I had imagined, much bigger than people like academics imagine, could actually be quite engaged in a powerful, essentially intellectual question or academic question. How did Shakespeare get from being the author of Two Gentlemen of Verona to being the author of Romeo and Juliet? And the movie's answer was something in his life, which I had been saying for years. Now, the movie's actual answer was Gwyneth Paltrow. And that probably isn't historically true.
But understandable.
but the idea that there was something about the way a life was lived in the case of Shakespeare that made a difference was something that in my own academic work I had been saying for years. So then I got the courage, as it were, to see if I could reach out beyond the smaller group of people
that one's work is tempered by the crucible of the things that happens in one's life, and one can mature as an artist as one matures as a person.
Exactly, and that it isn't only, although it certainly involves technical skill, what it means to perfect the writing of blank verse in Shakespeare's case, but something about his relationship to the entire world he lived in, just as it's about our relationship to the world we live in, to our immediate family circumstances and to the larger world we live in, that shapes the way in which we create, the way in which we receive works from the past, the way in which we live our lives.
Now, it seems to me, I don't know anything about it, but as you were speaking, because I didn't know this was going to come up, the Shakespeare in Love reference, there's movie posters out right now with a movie called Anonymous.
Yes, I saw.
And it seems like it's finally that question of, who wrote the plays? I have a feeling that that's probably what it is.
I haven't seen the movie, and I think it is that.
Mark Twain said they were written by Shakespeare or someone with the same name.
Yes.
Okay. Talking about why did you write The Swerve? We know already that it was a fluke that you picked it up and that it spoke to you. But then that was 17. It was many years later you wrote it. When you finally said it's time to write this, why?
Well, I was interested, as I've always been interested, not only in the poem, but as I say, the whole idea of a cultural shift or swerve. And I began to think about what would be the quintessential cultural swerve. What is the moment that most embodies the thing that we care about in the Renaissance, that most embodies why we think still that that moment was a remarkable moment for the human spirit and for civilization? And I hit upon this amazing story. And so I begin, to some extent I end, with the idea that a very simple event, but an amazing event. One day, January 1417, a papal bureaucrat who happens to be a very gifted book hunter gets into a library, monastic library, and he takes a book off a shelf. And in that simple act, no great symphonic chords around him, in that simple act, everything begins to change. So I'm fascinated by that moment. And that's really what the book is about.
I like that. Much of what I read in The Swerve was either new information or information that had been lost to me since college. I felt it was something similar to what happened to these texts, that at one point I knew this and somehow it had all been erased. So I'm going to ask you to set the context. How prevalent were books and literacy in ancient Greece, the Middle East, Rome?
Well, in ancient Greece and Rome, I can't speak to the Middle East very well. In ancient Greece and Rome, literacy rates were relatively low by our standards. They were not negligible. The elite would have been literate. This is also a slave society with large numbers of people who couldn't read or write, and also an agrarian society by our standards, so with large numbers of people who wouldn't read or write. But in the cities, there was some significant literacy, and even the beginnings of something like a literary public. There is a moment at which an ancient Roman historian, Tacitus, found himself in the Colosseum, and someone said, "Aren't you the historian Tacitus?" So that's the beginning of what looks like for us a literary culture. Nonetheless, it's small by our standards, and though it must have seemed like it would go on forever, there was a moment as the Roman Empire, the Roman world crumbled, in which the literacy rates fall catastrophically. The libraries are closed.
Well,
schools are
just
closed.
Just a second. Libraries. I mean, some of the things that I saw in here, like how many books certain writers wrote, and that there were public libraries.
They came in late, public libraries, late in terms of the ancient world. They came in at the time approximately of Julius Caesar. So the Roman Republic had been around for a long time, but there hadn't been public libraries. There had been many private libraries. But then someone came up with the idea of a public library. And then for several centuries, if you were an ambitious town in the Roman world with cultural pretensions, you had a public library so that people could go there. You could also go to the libraries that were in the bathhouses, so you could combine getting a massage, getting a bath, and also reading. But that whole world of reading fell apart. And it fell apart in a dramatic and drastic way, so that after a certain point, there was no longer, not only there was no longer a world of books, there was no longer the copying of books in a commercial way. Books began to disappear from the world.
And you tell us in The Swerve about the copying of books, that among the, that of course, that's how it had to be done, and that in the monasteries, it was part of their, it was like part of the practice of being a monk. When did that start?
It starts early in the monastic communities. It starts early partly because if you're a monk praying all day, you need to read something, so that at a very early stage, St. Benedict and others instituted a literacy requirement, in effect, for monks. If you have a literacy requirement, you need books. If you have books, you have to copy books because eventually they fall apart. And that turns out to be the only place virtually in this entire society for a long time, for several hundred years, in which literacy in any significant way survived. And it survived as a form also of penitential discipline. Copying books wasn't fun.
Right. And it was part of the practice. You're a monk, you do it.
Yes.
It's part of your job every day. You have to. Now, some were probably doing some of the farm work and so on, but copying books was a way to be a monk.
Yes.
And it was something you offered to the Lord.
To discipline your body, to discipline your eye and hand, and to serve the interests of the monastery and the greater interests of God by copying books. But the monks developed an interest in collections of books entirely, so that they also included pagan books in their collections. Sometimes they included the pagan books just because they were interested in the parchments. They could get hold of them. They could eventually scrape the writing away from the parchments and write them over with hymn books or liturgies. But sometimes they kept the pagan books because they were interested in them, or in any case, because they kept them.
But as you say, there was a drop, a great loss of literacy, of books, of reading. Was that because of the church?
Well, the church, in a sense, saved.
I mean, I know that on the one hand, the monks saved it, but was it also, you know, when Constantine converts and it becomes the state religion rather than the, you know, the seeker's religion, then they sort of clamped down. What was it that led to the, if not the elimination, the scarcity?
There are multiple things, Terence. First place, if there are barbarians invading your country, crossing your walls and taking possession of your cities, the last thing you worry about is the copying of books.
You grab your children, not your books.
You get out of there, and then often you were taken off to exile to work elsewhere. The idea of collecting books ceased. And so there's a whole set of reasons that had to do that, and of course many of these barbarian groups were led by warriors who were themselves illiterate and didn't need writing. But you also have your – it's true what you suggested a minute ago, that the church doesn't have a theological stake in literacy for everyone, for the masses. That is to say, you have religions – Judaism is an example – in which Jewish males are expected to read. It's part of the religious practice of Judaism going back to antiquity. So you absolutely expect and require – in effect, as part of the full participation of the community, that you have Jewish males will read. That's the bar mitzvah, is that, and so forth.
That's right.
So you'll have to read. But Christians didn't have that. Christians didn't believe that participation in the work of salvation required literacy for everyone. It did expect literacy for priests, at least most of the priests. Their literacy might have been a little shaky in some cases, but the on the whole, for the elite classes in the church, it required it, but not for everybody. And so the church actually did not insist in a broad spectrum on literacy for its faithful.
And we're not going to go into it, but there's a great deal there about how the church functioned, how the Vatican functioned, because the book hunter worked in the Vatican. We don't have time to deal with that. What I want to get to now is, who was Poggio Bracciolini? And how unusual was it to go around looking for books?
It was very unusual, Terence. It wasn't unheard of. There was a small group of people in Italy. Poggio Bracciolini was one of them. He was a poor guy from a family in a small town called Terranuova. It's now called Terranuova Bracciolini after its favorite son. His father had to run away from the town at a certain point because he was in debt. Poggio received some education, but arrived in Florence in the late 1390s with only 5 pennies in his pocket, he said. But he had some remarkable gift. He had fantastically good handwriting. And that, in a way, was the beginning of his career, because in a world in which governments and everything else depended on the production of documents, he could become a very gifted notary, a very good gifted copier of documents. And that's how he started. And he got a career launched eventually in the Vatican. But he held on to something he had acquired very early, which was a fascination with the possibility of finding up, dredging up from somewhere the traces of the past, the textual traces of ancient Rome.
I'm Terence McNally, speaking with Stephen Greenblatt. We're talking about his new book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. So one day, as you say, just a moment, he reaches, he's on bookshelves, he reaches and he pulls out On the Nature of Things by Lucretius. What was it about that book and its rediscovery that that you believe influenced the Renaissance? And as we, I know in the final chapter, we see Thomas Jefferson quoting it.
Well, for Poggio, it was probably nothing, just the name. He had probably seen the name Lucretius, because Lucretius was praised in the ancient world by Ovid and other contemporaries.
All his other books lost, but references
everything
to
lost,
him.
Everything from the philosophical tradition lost, and this great poem lost, for, not seen in circulation for 1,000 years. Poggio, who had been working for the most sinister pope in the history of the papacy, which is, after all, a distinction of kind, the pope gets thrown into a dungeon. He's stripped of his assistants, including Poggio, who was his secretary. So Poggio finds himself with time on his hands, and he starts ferreting around, and he finds this book and decides to recirculate it. Why is the book important? Because an entire philosophical school had been effectively lost. And that school said that the universe consists of innumerable, an infinite number of tiny, indivisible particles. The Greeks called them atoms, and emptiness and nothing else. And then that school began to try to think, what are the consequences of this belief? And the consequences turn out to be astonishing. The consequences for them turned out to be the fact that they thought a universe of this kind didn't need a creator. It didn't need intelligent design. It didn't need anyone pushing the atoms about. It was the consequence of an infinite amount of time of atoms banging together, separating, experimenting, in effect, with matter forever, producing species would disappear, come again, and so forth and so on. The soul with the body would die. There was no afterlife. There was no reason to think that you were either going to be rewarded or punished. All you could, as a human being, hope for was the enhancement of pleasure and the reduction of pain in a world in which you had to make up whatever meaning would exist in the world in the here and now. And that's what came back in 1417.
Which it's hard at this moment, as much as, you know, we have people who would say that that is not the truth and that, you know, God has told them elsewise, that way of looking at things could have disappeared and could be born again in this book is fantastic. What does the swerve mean?
Well, the swerve means a couple of different things, Terrence. In the first place, the swerve, as they say, is part of a general interest in how a whole culture swerves. How does it get from one direction to another? But behind that is a problem for these people in physics. That is to say, they wondered, why is it if there are atoms that they don't just fall in a straight line? Why do they bang into each other?
Right.
And what they said was that there must be an infinitesimal movement in each atom, a tiny swerve in each atom that creates this banging together. Now, that idea was ridiculed for a very long time, thousands of years, really, until quantum physics came along and said, yes, there is some kind of movement in the fundamental particles of the world. But for the ancients, for Lucretius, it also meant that there was the possibility of human freedom. Nothing was exactly as it had to happen because one thing, as in a chain reaction, was hitting another. There were strange movements in directions you didn't expect.
I mean, those mutations that serve natural selection for Darwin
are exactly what Lucretius had imagined.
Yeah. The pursuit of happiness as being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, it seems to me you say in some sense that goes back to this philosophy.
Well, in the first place, Terrence, you can be certain that no one running a state, for example, Queen Elizabeth of England, in the past, before the 18th century, thought that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were the purposes of a state. The pursuit of happiness would have been a very strange thing to imagine. The pursuit of virtue, the pursuit of glory, the pursuit of piety, perhaps, the pursuit of goodness, the pursuit of military triumph. I mean, many things you could pursue. Happiness is a very strange thing to imagine that a state could be organized for. And indeed, in the first draft, I think, of the Declaration of Independence, it said life, liberty, and property.
Mm.
And then there was a debate about this, and Jefferson came up with this extremely memorable, unforgettable phrase, the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson owned 5 copies of Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. He loved this work, and he said in letters that he wrote to his friends at the end of his life, I am an Epicurean. I am a follower of this philosophy. So that is enough for us of a trace, perhaps not a smoking gun, but a very vivid trace of the influence of this this recovery, this strange recovery of a lost world back into our world and very much shaping still the way we imagine our own lives.
Some of the other folks that you think influenced by this book and by Epicurean philosophy.
Perhaps the most interesting figure in my own immediate world is the great French essayist Michel de Montaigne, who was fascinated by the part of Lucretius that says explicitly, and it was the part that affected me when I was young, 17, death is nothing for us. Death is actually nothing for us. We don't have to spend our lives worrying about death and the afterlife. Death is when we don't exist any longer. It's not something that we need to organize our lives around. And Montaigne got that message incredibly powerfully. Montaigne, who wrote that when death came, he hoped death would find him digging cabbages in his garden. And so he's one crucial figure, but there are many, many others. You've already mentioned
Darwin. Galileo.
Galileo was in a crucial early work of Galileo's, The Assayer, said that really it was thinking about atoms and the void that we could understand certain physical phenomena that had eluded scientific understanding. He got in trouble for this because it was very difficult to reconcile this with certain church doctrines. But there are a succession of figures up to the modern world in which Einstein wrote a very interesting introduction to a reissue in German, a translation in German of Lucretius's poem. So this is a world that has been shaped by this strange event one day in January 1417.
Excellent. We're going to leave it there. The new book is The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. My thanks to Stephen Greenblatt. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence.